Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to ManCast. I'm Zach Birchie. Hope is here.
Hello.
And joining us once again for another live show, which typically means I didn't have time to plan an interview for this week. but this is a live show, so we're doing it live with the chat room. If you want to find out about these or when they happen, just follow me on Twitter at AnnaandZach, and you will find out there. I might start putting notices on the site or something at some point. I don't know. Joining us, as always... when we do these live shows, friend of the show, graphic designer, you've seen his work on such anime titles as, I don't know, name a few.
The Castle Cagliostro, which
No. I don't mean your, like, new stuff.
You mean my old stuff? Like, Sherlock Hound?
Sure, there you go. Anyway, Brady Hartle is here.
Yay, you said my name right.
I know,
yay,
right?
Three shows. Yay!
Thanks for thanks
next
for
time it'll be back to Hartel, and then he will just like react. If he'll be like, "Oh, that's wrong," he's like, "What? Really? I've never heard that before. It's wrong."
Right. Anyway, Brady, thanks for joining us. This is just a Twitter show, so we're just going to take some Twitter questions. But before we do that, you just had, speaking of Castle of Cagliostro, the DVD just came out, right?
Yeah, that came out at, like, technically December 26th, but. It got pushed back to the shipping to, like, write stuff in them by the 4th or something. So I think most people are getting it, like, now.
Yeah, from what I understand. But, you know, most of us are waiting on the Blu-ray, right?
Yeah, there's still months of work left on that, unfortunately.
Yeah, all right. Well, you know, every time there's a delay, I know who to blame.
Yeah.
It's you.
Just me and Reed running around in an episode of I Love Lucy.
Right, yeah. Well, so we're going to have you two on. We haven't scheduled yet, but at some point we'll have you and Reed on just to talk about that.
Okay.
So we'll do an entire episode just on your work at Discotech and on Lupin. So not too many questions on that, not tonight, just to, you know, save that for that episode. But anyway, so can you tell us anything else that's on shelves now that maybe you worked on?
Oh, what just came out? I'm trying to look around here, actually. Cyber 6 came out a while ago. That was, like, August.
Yeah, but so that came out, and we haven't done one of these, I don't think, since then. That Cyber 6 DVD, you were saying, like, somebody was like, oh, my God, thank you for all the special features, and that was, like, all you, right?
Yeah, I produced everything on that disc. Like, almost the entire disc. It's just me.
Right, and so you were getting, like, the fans that show has, of which I assume there are enough to make it break even or help him make a little bit of money, seem to appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. I got a lot of thank yous for that. I wouldn't say just me. Like, there's a lot of help. A dude in, like, Brazil got me a bunch of interviews with the original creators, which I talk about on the commentaries on the disc. There's a crazy history of that show, just how it was created. It's like just odd and fascinating, and like how the dude from Canada flew to Brazil and offered them like $1 for the rights to try to produce it, and then he came back to Canada and like wined and dined people to get money to produce it, and then it became like this weird thing where it's a Japanese production, but and it took me a while to figure this out, but going into it, it was actually pre-lay in Canada, so it was done in English first, and then a Japanese company, TMS Animation, animated it, and it's just like there's a the production on that show is just really ridiculous and crazy and just fascinating in how it ended up coming together and the fact that it actually came together. Yeah,
that's cool. Anything else?
Oh man, I wish I would have thought about this. There are so many things that came out that are all Discotech related.
Well, yeah, all the Discotech stuff. So there's that. Like, I mean, you do like video game covers and stuff too.
Oh, yeah. So, video game-wise, obviously, I guess a couple months back, Tales of Zillia 2 came out, which was the biggest thing I worked on all year. stuff like, I mean, there's dumb stuff like Digimon Data Squad and... or whatever. Digimon All-Star Battle, I think it was. It's a PS3 game. I can't remember which Digimon it was. Dragon Ball Xenoverse should be coming out. I've been working on that. That comes out soon, or it should be in beta now, I think. But I've been working on that. The new Ace Combat 3DS should be coming out soon. I just finished that as well. Just all the packaging for all that stuff. I'm trying to look at my folders because I work on a lot of things, and it is a lot of stuff to try to remember. Well, oh, Tales of Hearts R for 3DS came out, which is a lot of fun to work on that, actually. That was a neat little RPG game.
Cool. All right. Yeah, I just wanted to, a smattering. You work on a lot of stuff that people who listen to this probably buy, so.
Yes. Fun fact. Please keep buying and liking the Tales stuff, because I really like working on the Tales stuff. I've been lucky enough to work on the last three games. Three or four? Yes, four. The last four games, and they, keep coming back, so I'm lucky and happy to work on that stuff. I know what else I did. I worked on, it should be coming out, or it should be out, Bloodlad. I worked with Justin on the menus for that, all the animated menus. I did that, and I think Copelion is either coming out or something. I worked on the menus for that, too. So cool. There's that as well.
Excellent. Neither of those shows I remember being particularly, memorable. But I'm sure your menu work is excellent.
Yes, the menu work. I've not watched both of them other than to research it a little bit. But the Copelion had really nice art. Like, the art for that was really beautiful, so it was a lot of fun to work on that one.
Hmm. That's cool. Other than that, work aside, I assume the last couple months have been pretty busy for you, but have you seen any anime lately?
I'm sort of a season behind, so the last thing I watched is about half of Rage of Bahamut, which I liked. I wonder, the animation, and at least early on in that, is just amazing, and it's neat to see just character, in a weird show that's about a card game, I think, just actual characters and stuff, and just cool looking character designs and animation.
The story behind that is that that phone game makes bukus of money, and the company that owns it, Cygames, basically had all this money, and they were like, we like your work, Studio Mappa, we like a lot of the people working there, make this as a promotion for our mobile phone game, but you can do whatever you want with it, which is why it has the most non-marketable looking protagonist in the world, and a fun story and stuff like that. They gave them completely free reign. Because they just were bleeding money and said, sure, go for it.
They were just make something cool, and then they did.
Yeah, it was they were friends with some of the people that were on that were creative staff at that studio, and they were like, yes, just go crazy. Use our property and do whatever you want with it. And it's like, oh, okay, that's what you got. So, and it's pretty great.
That I enjoyed. I watched some of Fate's Day Night, which is, it's another retelling of that story. I guess better than the last anime, but I watched some of that. It was good. I can only pick up a couple, and usually I wait until you guys are like, oh yeah, this is good, watch this. So I've been doing that. I watched some of Sega Hard Girls, which was it's weird and goofy and that crazy CG, really low budget, but I found that kind of fun just for shits and giggles. But I haven't had, those are the couple that I've had time to watch lately.
I figured you were watching that Seiha Girls thing that sort of has your name written all over it, I think.
I haven't watched too much. I've only watched a couple episodes of it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely, it seems like the guys I know who are excited about that show or have been watching it are, dudes my age, maybe a little younger, who grew up, with Sega and, had a Sega Genesis and a Sega Saturn. And, it's for, older nerds, I guess.
It's for, a very niche audience.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how they're making money off of it, other than that, niche audience.
Right.
Like I assume that the reason they're like anthropomorphizing like Sega consoles is to try to like expand their brand to like the like I don't know Moe crowd or something, but it's sort of like, well, who is gonna like this other than people who already like Sega, I guess.
I think it's just a goof. I think the whole thing's just a goof. I really don't think there was much intention behind it. Behind, oh, we can take these Sega consoles and make like cute Moe 4 coma, you know, gag anime out of it. Like, you know, that's it. I don't know if it was like let's make Sega appeal to the hardcore otaku crowd. I'm pretty sure the hardcore otaku crowd is fully aware of Sega and everything
right.
they do.
No, yeah, exactly. It's sort of like going into that show, it's sort of like, oh yeah, I know this is pretty much for me and five other people.
Yeah. Well, it's probably you and several thousand other people, and like that's it, though. A couple thousand folks, maybe, that's it. So we just hit the winter season, so we're like right in the middle of that now. It's a couple of days old at this point. And so far, pretty quiet, I think. Is that how you would? That's how I would characterize it. It's quiet.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, yeah.
What are the two or three shows that you say I think these are going to go?
Well, obviously, yeah. Yuri Bear, yeah. Yuri Kuma, Arashi, the new Kunihiko Ikuhara thing that we've been talking up, and you know, it's funny, like the day that premiered. It premiered the same day as the giant, heavily anticipated, very expensive otaku, like most anticipated show by hardcore otaku,
mm-hmm.
Can Call, which is the anthropomorphic World War II Japanese battleship girls.
Right.
And, you know, we were passing emails around, and it's like, well, the biggest show premieres today, which is Can Call. And I'm like, well, you know, Funimation delay casted Yuri Kuma. But I think that one's maybe getting a little bit more people, like, talking about it. Like, I think that one's got more attention on it. And sure enough, the forums are, like, you know, 7 pages talking about Yuri Kuma and, like, one or two people going, Ken Call was neat.
Well, there's nothing to discuss.
There's nothing
like,
to say, yeah.
It doesn't... Well, that was my issue with it, was, like, I don't even... I get antsy around gun fetishism specifically for you know, specific reasons that Japan doesn't necessarily have in their market for that. But with the military stuff, I don't mind it so much. I don't mind the Strike Witches and the Ken Call stuff because it's based in, like, long military history. It's just bigger than that. It's a little different from me and my gun. It's bigger than that, and it's kind of neat, and there's a lot of interesting things about war history and stuff like that. But Ken Call doesn't do any of that. Like, it's... At least the first episode didn't, which was my only issue with it. It was like, there's nothing to discuss because they don't talk about, like, here's the specs of this World War II... battleship, or here's what the war is like, or here's what our fantasy version of it is like. They don't discuss any of that. Like, they just sort of leave it in the back, and it's like, but that's your premise. Like, have fun with your premise. I'm not learning anything about the world or the battleships or anything, which is a shame. So there's not really anything to discuss. It just sort of assumes that you already know this stuff, I guess.
Yeah, it seemed like it was very much just made for people who play and enjoy the game, and that's it. And that's fine. It's just that there's nothing much to say about it. So it debuted on the same day as, for us anyway, an Ikuhara show.
Yeah.
So obviously everyone's going to be taking that apart instead. And their attention was elsewhere. It turned out to be not quite the hype explosion that you maybe would have assumed.
Yeah, well, with Yuri Bear, it's going to be love or hate like it was with Penguin Drum, but even more so, because with Penguin Drum, people could just sort of choose not to watch it, but with Yuri Bear, it's this ancillary, like, what's the word for, it's a fire-starting premise, where you look at it, and it's like, oh, well, as an otaku, surely this must be made for me, and then you watch it, and it's like, oh, I guess it's not, you know, it's got the trappings of an otaku show, but surprise, it's an Ikuhara show, where Penguin Drum maybe didn't have that hook, so everybody's very love it or hate it in response.
Yeah.
So, being overshadowed by Yuri Bear, what else actually looks good? Is there anything else that looks good this season?
I'm super stoked for more Tokyo Ghoul.
It's all sequels. Like, everything is sequels.
Yeah.
For me, personally, not so much, because I'm not really watching. I mean, I'm going to catch up on Tokyo Ghoul, and I'm still catching up on JoJo's.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, like, the other anticipated show is Assassination Classroom.
Yeah.
Which everyone just abbreviates as Ass Class.
Which is great.
Yeah. And I'm looking forward to seeing that, but it's like, it's a Shonen Jump mega hit. So I kind of know what to expect from it, I guess, already.
I can't talk about, like, because they haven't, like, aired yet, but, like, Ass Class, Death Parade, and also that Maria the Virgin Witch thing, which the title sounds like a fan service show, but it's not. Like, it's supposed to be, like, the war between the Brits and the Saxons kind of stuff, like, real earthy fantasy. So I'm cool with that. Like, okay, like, the time of crappy, inefficient warfare and bad food, except there's magic in it. Like, okay, sure. But none of that stuff is aired yet, so I don't know. And the Magical Boy show I liked, but that's just, I think, because the director and writer are good, because that premise seems like it would suck. But the execution is good, so it's funny.
Yeah, I've been trying to catch up on JoJo's, too. I mean, I'm fine with just taking a leisurely pace on that show. I'm about, I would say, like, almost halfway through Battle Tendency at this point. I'm just having fun with that, just watching it whenever. It's not like, oh, I have to watch the next, but, like, I always enjoy every episode of that show I watch. It's always a lot of fun to watch that show.
Yeah, I'm currently stalled out at the end of part two, at the end of Battle Tendency. I really do like the show, but it is empty calories, if you know what I mean. Like, there's nothing to chew on there, nothing to think about. Like, I watch JoJo's just for funsies.
Well, yeah, it's turn your brain off. I mean, it's obviously, and you know, based off of a really long running old shonen manga. So
yeah.
The story, you know, when you go back, storytelling has evolved quite a bit since that was written. So, like, I try not to hold that against it, but like when I'm watching it, I don't sit there and be like, why isn't the plot more complex? You know, like, I just sort of sit down and watch it.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not expecting anything else from it. What I was going to say was, I only watch JoJo's Bizarre Adventure when that's the only thing that I'm looking for, is just turn my brain off, like, unwind before going to bed. And lately I've had to marathon a lot of shows because we're doing these single series podcasts that, you know, I gotta watch, and we picked like 50 episode series. So like right now, I'm in the middle of Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood. Ooh. I have another 20 left or so.
Yeah.
So JoJo's happens when I am in the mood for it and I have the time for it, and that just hasn't been as often. And the last couple episodes I watched, like towards the end of Battle Tendency, I found myself getting a little like, I need to take a break from this for a little bit, because I was watching big chunks of episodes like in a row.
Yeah.
So like, maybe I'm spacing it out like more so.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of feel exactly the same way. So like, this is when I feel like watching this, or whenever I have time, like I go to that and it's fun and I don't have to think too hard.
But I'm excited for, I mean, so I guess of the other stuff I haven't mentioned, this I guess there's people to bag on every season. This seems like a really strong winter to me. It does. Like, it's mostly sequels, but even the stuff that's not sequels, like, there's some really exciting stuff in there. But, so JoJo's is another thing, not just because it's more JoJo's, but it's actually my favorite part of everything that I've seen. I'm only familiar with the first three parts. I've not seen anything from, like, part four. I just know the basics, but, like, to me, the Egypt stuff, and then when they take it back home in JoJo's Part 3 is the best stuff, because it has Iggy, it has Darby, it has Dio up close and personal. Like, it's all the best stuff. So, yeah. So that's exciting. And also, there's more Durarara, and Durarara is also a good thing. So, to me, it's a really strong winter, but...
Man, I just could not get into Durarara, like... I tried, like, three times I tried, and I just couldn't get into it.
Yeah.
It just put me right to sleep. I don't know what it was.
It's not Baccano, like, but it is, it's good.
You're damn right it's not.
it's like three-fourths of a Baccano, but it is really good, and I kind of reinforced, I revisited the show a little last night, because I was like, I need to remind myself what happened in this for the sequel coming up, and looking at it, it's like, oh, this is really good. Like, this is really sharply written. These are good characters. The Ikebukuro itself is a character, kind of.
Yeah.
It's one of those... Well, hey, New York Prohibition era is a character in Baccano. Like, that's just how the guy writes. And it's...
It's like it's the fifth character in the film.
I know, it's a dumb cliche, but that's how he writes, and it works. It works really, really well for his stuff. And, yeah, Durarara, it's not Baccano, but it's got a lot of good stuff in it. It's funny. There's a lot of really good, heartfelt stuff. The problem with it is that Baccano had no bad characters. Like, it had... even its most boring characters it decided to spend the least time with, but it had no bad characters. Durarara has like two or three bad characters that you don't want to spend any time with, And that's mostly the problem. It's just that they even exist.
Yeah.
Well, out of, like, 14 people, there's three that it's like, no.
It's interesting that there's a sequel coming out this long after the faded popularity of the original. Like, I'll be curious to see what kind of impact that has, and if it sells really well, or if Aniplex decides to pick it up. Actually, they might have already said they're going to release it, but we'll see. I don't know. We'll see if the popularity of that thing has endured or not.
People just ask, like, what three characters do you mean? The ones that made it so Durrara was a hit with light novel readers and that audience, and Bakano wasn't, which is to say the self-insert children, the normal kids. They're there to, I guess, give the audience some identification or whatever, but, man, it's like, hey, Bakano was better because it didn't have any of these shitty, dumb, I'm just a normal teenager characters in it. Like, fuck those guys. Everybody else is better, but, you know.
I wonder if the second season coming out, like, if it's popular enough, we'll see a resurgence of the, you know, Durrara motorcycle cosplay thing.
Celtie, yeah.
Yeah.
She's the best character. That character's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's also, like, a simple, striking costume. Mm-hmm. So it was everywhere at conventions in, like, what, 2009 or whenever that show came out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I forgot how long ago that came out.
Yeah, it's a while ago. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get to these Twitter questions, because we got plenty of them, and we got to take questions from the chat, so, you know, we better get to work here. All right. Leaf For It asks, Sae Kano, he's referring to the show that just started airing today, or, you know, How to Raise a Boring Girlfriend, or Shirobako?
Shirobako. Easy.
I think of the two, like, I plan on watching all of Shirobako, but... probably definitely not on the other one. I know, yeah. I gave it a 4, but it just made me laugh, so...
Shirobako had a bad first couple episodes, and not even bad, like, there's no part of it that's bad. Shirobako had a pasty, like a mayonnaise-y type of opening episodes where it was, like, too steeped in, look at these moe girls, and then it was like something happened around episode 3 or 4 where they were like, okay, never mind the moe girls, let's just talk about animation production, let's talk about... all these different types of people who work in it, what their job is like, and it got real. It's like it had to start with the K-On! Thing and then go, okay, never mind, this isn't actually K-On!, we just had to start there. It's weird. But it's a good show.
My choice is Andy Barker PI.
That's a good show.
That's always the answer.
I think Shirobako is probably going to be one of the ones that you wind up going to, Brady, just because it's about the animation. In quotes, it's about the animation industry and has all these in-jokes if you know a lot about, you know, Japanese animators and stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's not much of a comedy, though. Like, it has some jokes. It's mostly drama, actually.
I looked at that and I was like, oh, that's got a neat premise. And then I'm like, well, this kind of looks just like, you know, K-On! Nonsense. But the fact that you said it actually grows out of that is more promising to me.
Yeah, I feel like it had to start with the K-On! Thing maybe to... I think maybe their thought process was, well, we need an in. Like, we need a reason for people to start watching this. Because the opening crawl shows these four girls or these five girls or whatever. And then, like, once you get into the show... three out of five girls of those girls disappear, and it's like about the heavyset director and the weird producer guy, and, you know, like, it's about the other characters and not, like, the personalityless ones. And then they give the personalityless ones characters later, like they give them motivations and depth. So it was like a bait and switch, really.
All right, the Mrax asks. I guess this would be for all three of us, although, Brady, I think I already know the answer for you. He wants to know if any of us are on board the No Game, No Life hype train, to which I can definitively answer no. I watched the first episode and was pretty put off by it. So, yeah, I don't know. Hope is taking an impromptu break in the middle of the taping.
I was really thirsty. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I should grab a soda. I'm back.
That's okay.
Trying to avoid the question, huh?
I might as well. Like, my opinion on No Game, No Life is exactly as it is written in the preview guide, because I didn't watch past that first episode. The first episode was so disgusting. I believe that it gets better, because something that stayed at that level really couldn't be that popular. It really couldn't. Like, it doesn't make sense, and the things that people have said about it indicate that there is more to it. But the first episode was so... it was everything I hate so firmly concentrated that I couldn't... I think it's ugly, too. Like, people say, oh, but it's pretty. Like, even if you ignore the the writing things that you don't like, isn't it nice to look at? And I think it's hideous. Like, I think that show is, the color sensibility is awful. It's tacky. It's like, it's like the parts of Artist Sally that are really popular, but the person can't draw. It's that where it's all bloom. Like, they go super bloom and there's not really any rhyme or reason to it. It's just sort of this tacky bobble. Anyway, hated that show. Couldn't watch more than an episode.
It's just like a light novel adaptation, right? Like,
yeah, it is. It's filled with dumb incest stuff and an unflappable, snarky protagonist who is secret perfect nerd. And yeah, fuck that. I don't care.
Okay. All right. So from Liu Derry, man, I wish I knew how to pronounce that. Asks a two-part question: what anime directors would you like to get more work? I mean, you know. The guys that don't get, although, like, you know, normally the first thing out of my mouth would be like Shinichiro Watanabe, and it's like he's had plenty of work.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I don't know.
No, you mean he just had a big show too?
He had two shows last year.
Yeah.
So
I like Seiji Mizushima's stuff. I even like Doedo Rocket. I understand I'm one of the five people that like Doedo Rocket, but I did. I like his sense of humor. I like his directorial perspective. What's his butt that just got Tokyo Ghoul? Like, I hope he gets a lot more stuff, because he's obviously got a strong voice as a director. Can't remember his name, but those two people, I guess. Oh, Sayo Yamamoto needs more work, too. So there you go.
That'd be cool. Yeah. I don't know. Off the top of my head, it's kind of hard to answer that question. If we put a list in front of me, I'd be like, oh, that guy. Oh, and that guy. Oh, and that guy. You know.
Yeah, Watanabe sort of would be my go-to, too. But, I mean, again, he just had two big shows, you said. I mean, I know one of them off the top of my head.
Okay, and the second question is one that we kind of have a prepared answer for. He's asking for our favorite movies of 2014, and both Hope and I have a top 10 list, and we thought we would run through them pretty quick. Briefly, we'll you know, say briefly what we liked about the film, but we put together these top 10 lists for, you know, favorite movies of 2014. Brady, did you scrape something together?
Yeah, I scratched them together. Not 10, but I got a couple good things, I think.
How many, so I know when to pull you in here?
I've got like 4 good ones that I liked, and a couple I was like, why did this come out?
Okay, we're going to go round robin until then, and then we'll pull you in.
Okay.
So, Hope, what's your number 10?
My number 10 is Nightcrawler, which is a Jake Gyllenhaal movie about a Nightcrawler, which is the occupation of, like, sort of a, not a paparazzo, but a, like, a news gathering, shock story news gathering team sort of thing. And it's just this one loser who, like, has no job and just decides that he's going to be a Nightcrawler. And, yeah, like, it's just sort of a look into the mind of a weird creepo that, like, gets work because the work is made for weird creepos. And it's really well shot and spooky, and it's kind of low because it was a little, like, on the nose. Like, it's a little obvious. Like, it's big flashing red lights obvious when it doesn't necessarily need to be. But, I mean, it was still a really solid movie. Liked it a lot, so, yeah.
Yeah, I like that movie a lot, too. We may hear about it a little later. my number 10 was Chef, which is a Jon Favreau movie. It's only on here because it was, like, a warm hug. Like, that movie was just, it's just a good time. Mm-hmm. Just, friendly, happy, good story, good acting, good dialogue. You know, real basic stuff. It's not going to, like, you know, take your world apart or anything, but I very much enjoyed it. And I've seen it a few times since it came out. And it's heartwarming, and I liked it a lot.
Right.
Okay, your number 9?
Number 9, Foxcatcher, which was a, like, Oscar buzz movie. Steve Carell's, like, this is going to be my super drama role, and Channing Tatum is being his Pokemon-like self. I call Channing Tatum a Pokemon because he's, like, this, like, big, earnest, beefy thing that you just sort of imagine would say his name over and over and do his best in whatever he's doing. I don't know. It's Channing Tatum being a block of Tatum. And, the whole movie is interesting because it's like, pure strain filmmaking and acting. Like, if you looked at the script for Foxcatcher and you just had the dialogue on the page and the actions on a page, you wouldn't understand why characters do literally anything they do in the movie. It's all shot composition and acting communicating like nonverbal things. And it's based on a true story that they didn't like pump up to be more dramatic. It's pretty much the facts of the situation as it happened, which is hard to like dramatize and make exciting, but you know, it's all in the filmmaking. It's really solid. It's really like unsettling, cold, distant, creepy stuff. And I like cold, distant, and creepy. And I like body language study and like cinematography that's illustrating things without dialogue. And this movie is like, hey, tell a story without dialogue pretty hard. And I liked that a lot, so, yeah.
Yeah, you liked it more than I did. I liked it, but it's more of a technical exercise than, like, a piece of art I really want to spend a lot of time with.
Yeah. Somebody said, I heard it had a crime photo-like quality. That is a very accurate description of the film, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like looking at a crime photo.
Speaking of crime photos, my number nine is Gone Girl, which is David Fincher's adaptation of the Airport book. And the movie had a lot of really cool things to say. I don't think it got as much praise as it deserved for being as tightly written as it is. Like, has a lot to say about roles, gender roles in society, the roles women have to play, that kind of thing. I was really kind of expecting it to be sort of a little bit more straightforward than it was, and instead I got something that was, I thought, pretty rich in meaning and also extremely entertaining and funny. And has really solid satire in it when it's going for that. I don't know, I really, really dug it a lot. So that would be your number eight, then.
Okay, number eight. Number eight is a movie that was VOD only. Like, maybe it was in a theater around here somewhere, so it, I don't, maybe not a whole lot of people have seen it, but they should, because it's really good. It's a really good, like, rare, simple, clean horror movie, and that was The Babadook, which was a crowdfunded Australian indie horror film. And it's good horror because it does what I feel good horror does, which is psychological horror that also trades in visceral visual imagery. So it's a lot of like very tight, it all means something. It's not just there to be gross or spooky. It's all imagery that is tied to the psyche of the protagonist, and it's like this single mother losing her mind thing, where the Babadook may be a real thing and it may be just in her head, but the point is, the point is not the facts of the situation, the point is the horror. And is really well acted, really well written, extremely good looking for having the low budget that it did, because it's a super low budget, like a couple million movie, and it looks like way more than that. So yeah, solid, spooky, good stuff.
All right, my number eight is Nightcrawler, which we already talked about. So let's move to your number seven.
You don't have anything to add, or?
No, it's all right. We're trying to get through these, so.
Okay, well, speed through it, I guess. Number seven was Mockingjay, which
great half a movie.
it was half of a movie. It's interesting because with these young adult fiction adaptations, like, so often it's like you have to ride on whether the material is any good. And from what I understand, the Hunger Games books sort of fall apart after the first-ish one. Like, even people who love them, like, when they talk about Mockingjay, it's like, bleh. And if I understand correctly, like, every fan of the book that I talked to said that the second movie was a huge improvement over the second book, and that's what people are saying about this one, too. And it's not a full film, it's the first half of a full experience, but it has so many, like, great solid moments of moral ambiguity. Like, it's the most, like, it's the most perfect, like, this is how you do moral ambiguity in young adult fiction. This is how you treat this is how you treat adolescents like adults in a respectful way while still speaking in terms that they can understand. And it's just solid. It's like the best of young adult fiction as an adaptation. Yeah, I mean, like, it's good stuff. It's stuff that I'm glad is popular. It's like, oh, this is a huge, high-grossing thing that kind of restores my faith in humanity and how much they want to challenge themselves through media and stuff like that. And it has an amazing sequence, the hanging tree thing, which is excellent. And that song, it's such a compelling sequence that song, which is pretty much a non-song, is, I think, in the top 20 on Billboard right now and has been for a month. It's, like, not even a song. It's just, like, a little lyric that goes back and forth into itself, called The Hanging Tree, and it's a great sequence in the movie, and yeah, it's good. Mockingjay.
I like Mockingjay. I think it, I don't know, I still, it seems like I'll know more once I've seen the other half of it, but it seems like it probably could have been like one film. I mean, there was so much padding in it, though, where it's just like, oh, hey, Katniss, now stand there. Okay, now we're going to film you with weird headgear and stuff. Like, there's so much of that in there that
it's extremely,
not necessary.
Yeah, it's extremely clear in that franchise, that's extremely clear. Like, they could have made it one movie. Like, the split is, like, literally, if you go in the book to where the first movie ends, it's exactly, like, the halfway point. Like, they just said, okay, end it here, and then we'll film the rest of the stuff afterward. Yeah. But, you know, that and The Hobbit, it's like, stop turning, you know, books that are maybe 350 pages, maybe 300 pages, into these giant 9-hour movies or whatever. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, not to say this is Hobbit bad, because, like, this is really, well, this is, you know, you can watch this, but it's just padded. Like, that's the only problem I had with it, just too padded.
My number 7 was Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. These movies are, I think, underrated at this point in time. I think they deserve, like, Best Picture nominations. They're that good. I need to rewatch this because I saw it the one time over the summer. I bought the Blu-ray. I haven't watched it again yet. But if they keep going the way they're going with this franchise, this is going to be, like, the best modern science fiction trilogy, or however many they make. If they manage to stay this quality, like, these movies are incredible. And people, like, don't give them the time of day because they're, you know, Planet of the Apes movies.
Yeah.
So good, though.
They're more than monkey movies.
Yeah. I think they deserve to be credited along with, like, the best films of the year. Like, when, you know, both of them have deserved that. And how often does that happen? Especially a reboot of a franchise that, you know, has, like, at least 3 bad movies in it. So that is my number 7. So let's go to your number 6.
My number 6 is, I'm looking at my list. This is the only, like, purely happy movie on my list. Like, the rest are super depressing. I mean, I guess my number 1 is kind of happy, but this is the only, like, thing that is not a dark exploration of, like, the horrors in human nature or whatever. And that's The Grand Budapest Hotel, which is a Wes Anderson movie this year. I like it a lot because it's funny, it's smart, it's Wes Anderson as hell, and it's like, I actually was not a fan of Wes Anderson in his earlier work, like, kind of at all. I didn't dislike it, I just sort of, eh. And it's like, starting with Fantastic Mr. Fox, moving into Moonrise Kingdom, and now this, it's like he's really refined his style to make, like, the best of himself in his films. And Grand Budapest Hotel was, like, a new high for him. I love the artificiality of it. It's very, like, it has an excellent sense of humor about itself. Like, it's supposed to be a funny movie, but it's also, like, sort of acknowledging its own silliness. I don't know. It's hard to describe. It's kind of like how Ikuhara, even when he's not making a comedy, has a sense of humor about what the thing actually is, even if it's really serious. It's that kind of thing. And I love that sensibility. It's really pretty to look at. Everybody's just at the top of their game in the cast, and it's just a fun time. Like, it's just fun, but it's, like, fun and arty, so there's that.
Yeah, it's a great movie. My number 6 is Whiplash, which is the movie that it's chiefly about, you know, the dangers of over-the-top masculinity, basically. It's a movie about a kid who wants to become a drummer. He's in a conservatory at a really prestigious school. What is his name? God damn it. J. Jonah Jameson.
Yeah.
What is the actor's name? Why am I blanking on
this? I don't know. I don't remember his name.
J.K. Simmons is
his name. Yeah, J.K. Okay. Simmons. Okay. Plays the sort of extremely tough, abusive, horrible instructor who's sort of trying to turn these kids into diamonds. And it's sort of about the absolute destructive and life-destroying effect that pushing yourself to the limit and there's no amount of abuse I can't take in order to become the greatest.
Mm-hmm.
Like the effect that sort of attitude will have on you. And it's tight, it's entertaining, it's pretty harrowing, and it's not that long. So it's really... It's a solid, solid movie. I'm pretty sure J.K. Simmons is locked for an Oscar nomination. I don't know if he's going to win, but I think he's nominated for Best Supporting. So if that's the case, then he's a shoo-in. He's definitely going to get it. But yeah, great movie. I really liked it. Really intense. Okay, so you're number 5 then.
My number five is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which I thought was, like, I thought the first movie was really good. This is what I would say is, like, 5 to 10 times better than the first movie, even. And I like it because it's not a monkey movie. It's not just a monkey. Full disclosure, I am an animal lover, and I don't like apes. Like, right. Actually, I don't like chimpanzees. They creep me out. I think they're kind of gross and terrible, and it makes me sad because I feel like I should love all animals, and I have no love in my heart for the chimpanzee. But I love these movies because they're excellent explorations of human nature and society, and they have such a depth of emotion. Like, they have an incredible depth of emotion to them, where the characters just feel so passionately about things, and they express it very on their sleeves because they're monkeys, and you know it's just interesting. And this movie is like showing the beginning of the Earth, kind of, because it's apes forming a society for the first time and learning about leadership and stuff like that. And it's great. It's a great action film, and it's a great character piece, and yeah, I loved it. So,
Brady, do you have a number five?
Yeah, so I want to preface my list by saying that I haven't had a chance to see, like, Interstellar, Gone Girl, Boyhood, Babadook, Birdman, or even, like, 22 Jump Street yet. So okay. I saw very few, you know, movies in the theaters this year, and a lot of these movies are, I look at them and like, I know this is probably going to be a good movie, but I know I can wait till it comes out, and they have not come out on home media yet. So my like number five, which I guess is sort of like just my fun movie, is I had a lot of fun going to see Dragon Ball Battle of Gods in theaters. I saw it with friends who I watched that show with when I was a kid, and you know, it really tickled a nostalgia bone. I actually think it was actually really funny, and it owed a lot to the dub script for that movie. No, it's kind of cheating, but that was in theaters, and I went and saw it in theaters, so I'm going to kind of count it. And I'm glad that movie is more goofy and ridiculous than it is, like, fighting. I was afraid it was just going to be, like, Goku and some other dude, like, flexing their pecs at each other for, like, an hour, but it was really sort of that old, like, Toriyama sort of hijinks. And I know, like, his comedy is sort of, you know, hit or miss. I think comedy in anime is hit or miss, you know, period. But you know, I really liked that and had a lot of fun, and I actually laughed out loud watching some parts of that movie. So that's sort of my number five.
That's cool. All right, my number five is The Babadook, which we already talked about. So I think it's the best horror movie I've seen in a really long time. And, you know, good horror movies have a tendency to be kind of overhyped, because if there's a good one that's, like, not the worst thing in the world,
right,
everyone loses their mind because there's so much in that genre and none of it is good. And then something that's really good comes out and everybody just goes apeshit, so to speak. But yeah, I loved it. It actually scared me, too. Like, I was actually scared watching that movie. So, Hope, you're number four.
My number four is Whiplash, and the only thing I want to I echo all the stuff that you said about it. Also, I think the thing that stood out the most to me about Whiplash is that it very specifically chooses a thing that it's not even a, like, I'm going to be the greatest at, like, a thing that the world esteems. It specifically chooses jazz band, which is a thing that the world doesn't really care about. And the movie is aware of that because it, like, shows the audience for any given concert or scouting or anything like that. And it's very small. It's very tidy. Nobody knows what he's talking about at family dinners, that kind of thing. But it's his entire world, but it's something that doesn't, that is not esteemed in the world, but it's really important to him. And it's able to use this as, like, a microcosm for, like, the pressures put on men and patriarchy, whatever. But, like, the pressures put on men to, like, become the greatest and to push your limits and to, you know, the world will be yours if you just work hard enough, that kind of thing, in a really twisted, awful way around a thing that doesn't matter very much. And I was reminded of the old... And it's about a drummer and a conductor. Like, so it's a drummer and a conductor who are, like, pushing their limits, and they're like, I'm going to be the best. And there's an old joke about orchestra. What do you do if a guy in a brass section or a woodwind section can't play his instrument? You hit him over the head with it, you give him two sticks, and send him to do the drums. What if he can't do the drums? You take away one of his sticks, and you make him the conductor. That's an old, dumb orchestra joke, but it's very true of Whiplash, so it's, you know. Anyway. So, yeah, number four.
All right, Brady.
Number four. I would say that my number four is Edge of Tomorrow. Oh, I thought we were on number. Wow, I counted wrong. Oh, Noah. I'm sorry. I really liked that movie. It was a cool take on a biblical story, and they made it into like a sci-fi fantasy kind of film. And I just, I don't know, I thought it was a cool take. All the visuals are really cool, how they show, you know, how they visualize the fallen angels and all that sort of stuff. Just a neat movie.
Yeah, you'll probably hear more about it coming up here. my number four is Inherent Vice, which I thought might be lower, but the movie really stuck with me after seeing it. And I liked it a lot more than upon leaving the theater. I was like, well, then it just stuck with me, and I kept thinking about it and replaying moments in my head. And I really enjoyed it. It's not Paul Thomas Anderson's most focused film. It's definitely kind of all over the place, but in terms of being like a movie that's sort of about, I mean, the title references what the movie is about, which is the inevitability of the destruction of the hippie dream in the late 60s.
No, the hippies.
And it's kind of funny. It's got mostly I like the vibe. I like the vibe of that movie a lot. It has a real soaked in Southern California feel to it. Like, he captured that like perfectly. I really like the performances, and every time Joaquin Phoenix and Josh Brolin share the screen together, it's really, really good. Really liked it a lot. I'm actually looking forward to it coming out on Blu-ray so I can watch it again. Right now, I'm actually in the middle of rewatching all of Paul Thomas Anderson's movies, so it's fun just to go back and revisit them and, you know, reorder them around in my mind. But yeah, big fan. I liked it a lot. Number four. So Hope, you're number three.
My number three is Gone Girl. I like David Fincher as a director a lot, but he does have he's a hardcore dude movie director. He makes like the dudiest dude movies to ever dude. But they're valuable. Like, they're smart. They're complex. They're deep. They're wonderfully shot. I mean, he has an aesthetic that's a little oppressive, but that's the point. But Gone Girl was the first time the script is written by the author of the book, which that can go sour pretty fast. And there is dialogue. Most of Gone Girl's dialogue is not naturalistic, but it's acted in a way that it works. It's not realistic or natural, but it works as dialogue. And it's a really compelling, like, tight, tense, your heart is thudding in your chest, all the stuff you associate with David Fincher, except for once it is not a dude movie. It is a movie about women, and it's not it's a very feminist film. However, it is not the kind of feminism that people can rally behind quickly and easily. Feminism is people, women are equal as people to men in all the bad ways as well as the good ways. It's not a girl power feminism. Girls can be superheroes. Girls can conquer the world. It's girls can be horrible, monstrous, sociopathic murderers. And here are the weapons that they use, because these are the weapons society has given them. Like, they use sex appeal. They use assumptions that men make about what women are capable of versus what they actually can do. You know, it's the protagonist is not she's not a good person, and I think that that's important. It's like, okay, you can have a story about a compelling, masterful serial killer kind of character, and it be a woman, and that is fine, and that's good. And, I really loved it. And there's a mic drop. Like, there's the, like, best speech of the year in the movie right in the middle, delivered by the main female character. And it's just, like, walking out into the stage of media and just, like, dropping a microphone really loudly. And that kind of made the movie for me, that monologue in the middle. So, yeah.
Cool. All right. Brady, you're number three.
Edge of Tomorrow, Live, Die, Repeat, / All You Need Is Kill is my third movie.
Cruise Blunt.
Cruise Blunt, starring Cruise Blunt, Edge of Tomorrow. Oh no, I think it's, you know, it's how sci-fi action movies should be done. Like, it's I was glad it's a superhero film without being an actual like Marvel comic superhero film. You know, I mean, like, all those superhero films that came out this year, like Captain America: Winter Soldier, which was a, you know, good thriller or whatever, and even Amazing Spider-Man, which I think is more, why did you make another Spider-Man movie? We've done enough of those. Like, I mean, they were fine and good. You know, they were superhero movies. And even, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, which I think people will probably be surprised. It's not on my list. It's just, it was okay, but it's just full of all this Marvel bullshit. Like, Edge of Tomorrow was just super fun and had a neat idea, and they portrayed it well, and they, you know, just the visuals of the monsters are just really cool and frightening, with being also being new and not like derivative of like something. Like, I guess, you know, it sort of harkens back to Alien a little bit, but it's just a really neat movie. And like, you know, I think that I wish it did better. Like, that's, I know it did well enough, but I wish it did better because it was a super fun movie. And, you know, I think people should sort of like put aside their Tom Cruise hate. And the thing is like, if you hate Tom Cruise, he dies a lot in this movie, so you would probably like it anyway. Like, that's sort of my take on it.
Yeah, I liked it a lot, too. I think it would probably be on a top 15.
Yeah.
Not a top 10, but definitely a top 15. That movie's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. It was good.
I kind of want to watch it again. It's a good thing the Blu-ray was in all those crazy Black Friday sales for, like, nothing. So.
Yeah,
when we get it, it's like, what do we... Because they have everything alphabetized. It's like, where do we put this? Because the title is so...
Which title do
nebulous.
We use?
Yeah. Yeah.
My number three is Grand Budapest Hotel. I think Wes Anderson's on an upswing. He's just making great movie after great movie. His decision to just embrace comedy has been really great for his creative output. And he's talking about doing another stop motion, like Fantastic Mr. Fox, and that makes me really excited. So, yeah, great movie. So hope you're number two.
I was actually going to say, I just watched Moonrise Kingdom and loved that, so I'm really looking forward to checking that out.
Yeah, you'll probably dig it. I like it more than good. Moonrise Kingdom, actually. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, go on.
Yeah, it's hard for me to pick. They're all really good. Number two is Noah, and I like Darren Aronofsky. I like him more. I too think he's kind of like Wes Anderson in that he is making, like, progressively better movies over time. Like, I think he is only improving as a director. And, Noah is weirdly in touch with people like, oh, he just took the story and interpreted it in whatever weird modern lens he wanted to. And it's weirdly in touch with like the very base, like old as dirt Semitic roots of the story. It's not like weird contemporary conservative Christian interpretations of the Bible now. I mean, there's modern attitudes and there's like sort of timeless fantasy elements to it, but it's also kind of rooted in the beliefs of what would be Noah's time, or at least the time where Noah's story was written. And it's you know, it's super compelling. It's a gorgeous movie. It has a lot of really unique uses of effects that are that seem like unearthed and old and weird, and you know. I don't know, it's just a super compelling movie with a lot of great complex characterization, moral ambiguity. It acknowledges the existence of a God in this world, but it's not like Noah good, other people bad. It honestly questions how humanity would react to a world in which God was existent and present and communicated with him. And it's a really solid, awesome fantasy movie. So, yeah.
All right. Brady, you have a number two?
Yeah, I'd say for me, and this is Lego Movie. I love Lego Movie. You know, that movie could have just been about shilling toys the whole way through, and it had a lot of heart. And I mean, it all hinges on like the end of the third act for that movie, really. But I think it's just kind of has like a really nice heartwarming story. I think for kids, it's especially good because it's not that movie. The main character Emmett in that movie he's not cynical. Like, I think a lot of kids' media today is just all cynical. Here's this super edgy main character dude. He has his cap on backwards while he's skateboarding down the back of a dinosaur. Like, Emmett is sort of like a very earnest and like he just wants to be helpful and good and kind. And I think a lot of, you know, media for kids don't have that nowadays. And I really loved it. And I think the story that I don't want to spoil it, but how the story turns out towards the end is just sort of another thing that more kids media needs.
Yeah. I like the Lego Movie too. That would also be on like a top 15, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I have not seen Princess Kaguya yet. So, it is the best animated film of 2014 for me by default, because everything else was junk.
What, Princess Kaguya?
Oh,
the
Lego Movie.
Oh, okay.
Everything else was total crap.
This is like the first year, I would say, in a long time where if I was making a top 10, because I love animation and I do bias it a little bit when it comes to favorite movies of the year. This is the first year in a long time I can say, like, there would be no animated movies on my top 10. Like, immediately I was like, oh, there's nothing on there. Because the only one I liked was the Lego Movie. And it was like, this is a fun comedy, but it's not like top 10. I didn't love a top 10, so. Grr. You know.
Okay.
Bad year for cartoons.
Yeah. All right. My number two, I think we have the same number two and number one. My number two is Noah. Everything you guys said, it's a great movie. I'm just going to let you talk about our number one.
Well, we can both talk about it.
Well, yeah, you know, take it away. We got to get through this because we got all these Twitter questions, then we got to take questions from the chat. So
let's make it
snappy.
Okay, Birdman. Inari Itu, the director of this film, has gotten some flack for being pretentious. His movies have been divisive. Los Amores Perros and Babel were both pretty divisive. He's made other stuff, but like I remember that those two being some of the most talked about as far as like, yeah, I loved it, or grr, I hated it. And I like his sensibility a lot. I like his style. I liked both of those films. And this one is just like his like explosion of, I don't know, this is like his big movie. This is his, I don't know, like, you could think of an example, like, when a director comes to prominence and everybody really sits up and takes, it gets their attention kind of unequivocally, whether they like it or don't. It's this weird, like, movie as a stage play conceit that's about the psyche of actors and also about the world at large, and it's about, like, a lot of things. It's this crazy, surrealist, I don't know, this is bonkers-ass, surrealist, visceral thing that's about, like, different types of media and people's reaction to them and people that work in the media, whether they be actors or critics or celebrity chasers, viral addicts, that kind of thing. And it's just, there's just so much in it. And it's just Inari Itu, like, screaming through people for about 2 hours and saying, like, really powerful, compelling things. While yelling and occasionally asking, literally in the movie, asking too much, and then ignoring that and keeping and continuing to scream. Like, so it has my, like, the reason I like it so much is the same reason I like Grand Budapest Hotel and stuff like Yuri Kumo, which is it has a sense of humor about its intensity. It's like about intense, serious things, but it has a strong sense of humor about how it's going about it. It's not like too dark or whatever. It's you can laugh at it while acknowledging that it's talking about very dark, serious, big things. So yeah.
Yep, great movie. Brady, what was the best movie you saw?
I really am looking forward to Birdman, but my favorite was Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. I went into that seeing like Rise like right before, like 2 hours before it, and Rise was just a really good movie, a good father son tale that unfortunately father and son go, you know, their separate ways. And I went and saw the second one, and you know, I was like, they're completely, you know, they make you like the characters in the first one so much, and they're focusing on just one of the characters from the first movie, and they managed to make a sequel to that movie with, you know, very few of the same cast other than, you know, Caesar. And they make you care about this, all these, you know, CG apes throughout this movie, and the struggle between the human, you know, humans and apes and all that. And I just love that movie. I thought it was a great movie, and just just everything you guys said earlier too.
Yeah, it's a cool movie. I thought you were gonna say Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, because that's 100% my favorite. I love bro culture, and I want everybody to be bros.
Yeah, so we actually do have bottom fives that we're just going to go through real fast. I got a bottom six, because there was one I forgot about that it needs to be on here, but I want them both to be on here, and it's my list, so fuck it.
Mm-hmm.
Number six.
Your show.
Number six, Mr. Peabody and Sherman. Terrible fucking movie. Number five, Muppets Most Wanted.
Oh, God.
Number four, Amazing Spider-Man 2, which you liked.
What? Me?
No, Brady.
No, I thought it was fine. No, see, here's my thing with that movie. I don't think it's a bad, like, a terrible Spider-Man movie. I just think they didn't need to make another Spider-Man movie. That's
you're absolutely right.
It's very
there's like nothing really wrong with the movie. It's just not a Spider-Man movie.
You're completely wrong. Okay. Number three, Wish I Was Here, Zach Braff. Number two, Sin City 2. Number one, Million Ways to Die in the West. Yeah, don't watch any of those movies. I hope you have a really similar list, right?
I think it's the exact same, except I would also put in place of Muppets Most Wanted, which I think, in fact, it's the same thing as you, where it's like taking something you love and taking a dump on it, and therefore you hate it more, even though it's maybe not as offensive. Like, I didn't think Muppets Most Wanted was like, I thought it was just neutrally roll your eyes bad. I didn't think it was horribly offensive, but like, I would put in its place something that is probably on the same level, but I was more attached to, which is Annie, which is taking the material, going, we don't care, and taking a huge steaming dump over it, and having a bunch of, like, shitty showbiz jokes. Like, it was made by guys who wanted to inject it with, like, crappy showbiz jokes and, like, mean-spirited humor and make all... score all the songs on a Casio and nobody can sing or act, and ugh, it's just cheap and lame and shitty. So, yeah. But other than that, I think my list is the same. And there's, like, a special dispensation movie. Do you want to...
Oh, yeah. The special dispensation is for Jay and Silent Bob's super groovy cartoon movie, which did not have an actual theatrical release and wasn't released directly to video on demand. It was given a standard DVD release and then a video on demand, so it was kind of straight to video, so it kind of doesn't count. But it is, like, maybe the worst movie I've ever seen in my life. So, yeah. I think it's like, that. These are things you have to take time to consider. But yeah. I think it might be the worst thing I've ever seen.
It was terrible.
I mean, mine is pretty... I mean, like, Ninja Turtles. I mean, not that it was, like...
Watch Jay and Silent Bob with us? How could
yes,
you
I did. No, that's not my
Ninja
number
Turtles
one
worse.
Movie. I have a couple different things.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no.
You were there.
No. Jay and Silent Bob is by far the number one worst movie I've seen this year. But no, like, I think Turtles is, like, at the bottom of my bed, so it just was nothing. Like, it was just a nothing movie. Whatever. I was horribly disappointed in How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Yeah.
I wish that was a better movie. It's visually stunning. So many amazing shots in that movie, but amazing shots and animation aren't going to save no story. No, like, just meandering around. Like, you, and if you can't even do a son find his mother plot, like, why, like that's the basic, most basic plot, and they didn't even get that right. Like, it just, I was so disappointed in that movie. Muppets Most Wanted, just, I was so, after the first movie, which was, I love the first movie, it's really disappointing that it already went to pot, you know? Like,
yeah, it's already crap, like, yeah.
Yeah.
For hours.
Like, And the thing is with the promotion of that movie, like, they knew they had lost the, they barely promoted it. And, like, I remember you telling me a story about how, like, when you went to Disney, it was barely, like, on, like, one of the Disney 3D rides or something. Like, they just had, like, a poster, like, hidden in the back or something.
Yeah.
Like, that was the promotion. So, yeah, those two, and obviously Jay and Silent Bob just... Transformers Age of Extinction, honorable mention for the beer scene.
Oh, yeah. Transformers wasn't bad enough to make it on. I mean, maybe not even, like, a top or, like, a bottom 7 or 8. Like, it'd probably be in a bottom 10, but it was less offensive than some of the other Transformers movies. I'm not saying that I don't support this film at all. I'm just saying, of the bad shit I saw this year, it didn't come anywhere near the stuff that's in that.
Yeah, I mean, Transformers mostly just put me to sleep. And then I woke up during the dumb Bud Light joke, and then I went back to sleep.
Yeah, you were awake for the best part. Okay, we got to move on. Let's go with this one from my anime waifu, who asks, do any of you think the live-action Ghost in the Shell movie will actually get made? Right now, it looks like it's going to get made, but we'll find out what happens when they nail down a budget. We'll find out what happens if they actually start filming. Like, once that movie starts filming, there you go. Like, then we're going to see it, but not really until then. So, they have Scarlett Johansson attached. That means it's probably going to get made. So, probably.
Of, like, anime to get adapted, like, it's pretty easy to adapt that sort of story. Yeah. Into, like, a sci-fi thing?
Yeah, it's going to be a pulse-pounding cyber slam. That's what it's
going to be. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, fighting crime in a future time.
I really do predict, like, I honestly think mid-range budget, $40 to $50 million, dumped into theaters February or September, in Redbox by Christmas if it doesn't come out a month before Christmas.
They'll take, like, the bones of the premise, and therefore it'll be kind of uninteresting and, you know, just...
Yeah, I think it'll be a dull sort of sci-fi action movie that plays to cheap seats globally. I think that's what they're going to make there.
Right.
Not that I think the source for this was, like, amazing or anything, but it feels like it's going to be like the Aeon Flux situation where they sort of just did a by-the-numbers kind of...
Yeah, Aeon Flux is a good comparison.
Yeah.
Remember that live action movie? That Yes. It's going to be kind of like that, I think.
Well, as long as, you know, there's no way it's going to be as good as Ultraviolet, so...
Oh, God. the green screen.
Yeah.
Oh, everything's green screen.
Yeah. She's got a green halo on her orange hair all the time. And
I remember that. What's that motorcycle scene with all the explosions and everything near the end of that movie is just amazing.
All right. Aquajaka asks, how high or low are your expectations right now for the upcoming 2015 animated movies? So there's a bunch of stuff coming out this year. Notably, there are two Pixar movies this year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have particular faith in either of them. I don't know if I'm just being too cynical about Pixar, but it's not like their output is stellar anymore. And this is one movie that the trailers are making out to be terrible, Inside Out.
Yeah.
That second trailer, the sitcom-y trailer with, like, huh, men and women don't think alike at all. Like, that's so fucking hacky. It looks so bad.
It's like, was this written in 1962? Like,
yeah, it's so, God, it's hacky. And then the other one, The Good Dinosaur, which comes out in November, is suffering from the same creative team problems that Brave had. So, yeah. And Brave was bad. So, I don't know. Not really. I guess pretty low. Like, I'm not expecting him to be horrible.
What's Disney putting out next year?
Nothing. It's two Pixar.
Oh.
There's no Disney feature animation movie this year, I don't think.
DreamWorks?
Next year. DreamWorks is... they're making that... We saw a trailer for it. It was, like, Space Alien and Little Girl, and the Space Alien is the nerd guy, the super nerd guy from Big Bang Theory.
No.
So,
oh, that looked awful. Oh,
it looks
Jesus.
Bad. It looks really bad.
That looked super awful.
I mean,
and
it,
Inside
it
Out...
It doesn't look as bad as Inside Out. I'll be straight with you. Like, I didn't think it looked as bad as Inside Out.
Peanuts might be good. The trailer was
Oh,
cool.
Yeah. That looked kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I'm cute. Yeah, Peanuts... I really liked the coloring on Peanuts. I think they somehow in CG captured that flat like Schultz look to it,
and it
looks neat. I think it looks cool.
It looks cool.
If they can capture, if they have not been able to successfully recapture the very specific and like the very specific sense of humor that Peanuts had, which is not really replicated like in other media. Like it's not like Charles Schultz had an extremely specific sense of humor that's sort of morose and sweet all at the same time, and like. Peanuts Media has not been able to capture that in, like, 20 years or something like that, so it would be cool if this could, like, recapture that. I don't know. It's kind of like The Muppets where it's super hard to do, but you could try.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic about the SpongeBob movie that's coming out. I know that they brought back the original creator to write on it, so I hope it's good. I really like the first SpongeBob movie, so...
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I figure... Post-movie SpongeBob, like the show, post-movie SpongeBob is not really watchable, so I don't have high hopes for this movie, but...
Probably going to wait for a rental on that one.
Yeah.
Rather than go to the theater for a SpongeBob movie.
No.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Okay, moving on. Linus01 asks, what are your thoughts on Sailor Moon Crystal as it wraps up the Dark Kingdom arc? My thoughts are I didn't watch and I'm not watching and have no intention of watching Sailor Moon Crystal because everybody I trust says it's a big pile of dookie, so I'm staying away from it.
Yeah, I didn't watch through all of it. I would just pop in and watch, like, whatever. Like, when people were like, okay, this thing happens at this time code or whatever, then I would look at that. But all I know is that somebody did a analysis of how often the Sailor Scouts spend... doing anything versus how much time they spend unconscious or restrained, and it was they spend out of the 12 or 13 episodes, they spend 21 minutes straight restrained, and they spend 8 minutes in any kind of proactive action. And I was like,
someone's
well,
counting that, okay.
Yeah, that you know, it's bad. It's really really bad. I'm not really a fan of Sailor Moon or anything. I don't dislike it. I don't have attachment to it. So just watching it as is this a compelling story? It's garbage. It sucks.
It's sad that it's such a cheap adaptation of it.
Yeah, it's weird that they're not spending
any money. There's no money in it. It just looks... And the funniest thing about... I mean, there's a million things you can laugh at in the terrible animation of that show, but the funniest thing to me is they just can't stop drawing a huge badonkadonk on Luna. Like, they can't stop drawing this huge cat butt. And it's like, why do you draw the cat like that? It doesn't even look like that in the manga. Like, why does she have this huge... But
look, furries like, need some love too, around, right?
She's walking around and she's in three segments like an ant. Like she's in three segments like a weird insect, and her backside is this huge. Like, did they base her on like an ant or some other small insect, a beetle? Because she's a huge cat butt.
That's the new twist. Sailor Moon Crystal. She's not a cat anymore. She's really a bug, and they want everybody to look at her bug butt.
I think the thing on Tumblr that went around about it, the thousands of notes or whatever, was somebody's got to calm their booty game on Sailor Moon Crystal. Calm that cat booty game.
Bunny Bookends asked about whether how Sailor Moon Crystal is being received by fans in Japan, if it's even airing on TV. No, it's actually a web-only series. The Blu-rays are selling... They're up to volume 3, and I think lifetime sales is, I don't know, 4 or 5,000, something like that.
The streaming numbers for the show, because I follow a blog that catalogs all this, that's why I knew the runtime thing. And the streaming numbers for the show were 1 million, some, no, it was 2 million something views for the first episode, 700,000 for the second, and then they've dropped to 100,000 something by the newest episode.
Oh, man.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch.
And it's like a first four episodes are up in the 700,000 to 500,000, and then starting with episode 5, they shoot down to like 300,000. Now they're at 100,000 for the past three episodes or so.
I really am curious how those numbers like match up to the old dusty 80s cartoon that they're simulcasting as well. Like, I wonder what the...
It's a 90s cartoon.
Yeah, the old one.
You know what I want? Like I said this before, but I want the tell-all book about what the fuck happened with Sailor Moon Crystal more than I want Sailor Moon Crystal. Like, I want the story behind the... I mean, just hilariously botched... launch and execution of that show.
Well, it was like 2 years in the making, too, right? Like, they had sort of announced it way back.
It was
back,
delayed,
right?
Like, almost a full 2 years, I think, before actually airing. It's ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous. Okay. DMH21148 asks, were you surprised about Crunchyroll getting hacked, and do you expect other anime gaming sites possibly being next? It was fucking crappy that happened. I hate that shit. They are obviously just going after media companies. Crunchyroll is the dominant player for anime, and they're visible and available on like a million devices, so I don't doubt that they got that in their heads to take them down as a target. Incidentally, right when that was happening, ANN started getting DNS threats through email. My boss actually talked about this in the forums a little bit. It was an extortion attempt. That is why you're seeing DDoS checks when you go to ANN right now, because we're being careful. It's hackers trying to, you know, extort people for things, and it's fucking bullshit, but welcome to the future.
I mean, yeah. They did the same thing to Xbox Live and PSN over Christmas, which was such a shitty thing to do. Like, all those kids opening their present, they can't even use it. You know, like, so why be dicks? Especially over Christmas, right?
Yeah, it's fucking bullshit. I hate that. I hate that shit. This internet culture stuff is just going to get worse. We're at the tip of the iceberg here. I would imagine in the next, like, 10 years, like, it will get way worse than this before it gets better.
And then it's going to become to a point where law enforcement is going to take it seriously. And it's not, because, like, right now it's just like, LOL, I just knocked down Sony or whatever. And they're... generally these people, they just don't do anything. They just push back up their shit and then go on, and somebody needs to be made an example of out of all this stuff.
Big time, yeah. And once you start seeing people go to jail, that's when things will change, but it has to happen first. And what that means, sadly, is that there's going to have to be a direct cause and effect. Internet threat leads to murder. Unfortunately, like, that is what it takes to push society. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things move so slowly in this country that, you know, a year and change ago, a dude shot up a bunch of kindergartners in a school and what happened with any kind of mental health laws, anything come of that? No, nothing. No change. And a whole bunch of kindergartners died. Mm-hmm. Like, that doesn't even get people to stop, to make any kind of, like, change to the laws in this country surrounding this stuff. This is fucking ridiculous. Absolutely fucking ridiculous. Like, I don't know what will have to happen in order for them to start taking the internet seriously as a place where real crime happens, but and it's going to be a while. Anyway, so that's enough Twitter questions. We have the chat here, and we really need to get to the chat. So right now is your time to give us questions from the chat. Thanks, everyone, for sitting here listening and, taking part of the show. Okay, first one, Brainchild asks, I know you guys aren't necessarily manga people, but what are your thoughts on Digital Manga's latest Kickstarter campaign for a reprint of one of their yaoi series? Okay, Digital Manga, I think, maybe needs to cool it with the Kickstarters for a little while. Like, I don't know, Brady, have you followed this at all?
No, I have not. What's the rundown of this?
Well, you saw their big Tezuka thing over in October, right? Where they tried
to do that.
Which just fell on its face. And so then just recently, in the wake of that, almost immediately, they had another Kickstarter up to launch Ludwig B, which is an unfinished manga from the end of Tezuka's career that he died before he could finish. It's not particularly beloved, but I guess the goal is just let's just put everything that Tezuka ever even looked at or thought about out in the U.S. Mm-hmm. That succeeded barely. And now I guess they're doing another Kickstarter to reprint one of their old yaoi titles. I think they just see Kickstarter as like, here's how we are going to do anything. Like, here's how we will raise all of our money by mitigating all of the risk through Kickstarter on like, we're not going to take a single risk on publishing anything without the guarantee of Kickstarter money. Good luck to them. I think like doing it that way over and over and over again is going to thoroughly exhaust whatever audience you have, whatever loyal customers you have that are showing up every time. If it's Kickstarter and then a year or more to publication for everything, man, you're investing in like a book you're going to read a year plus in advance every time for their entire like publishing catalog.
Wait, it's a year? Like there's a year to publish from the Kickstarter for their manga?
I don't know if it's exactly a year, but it's usually about that for a Kickstarter project, right? I mean,
for a manga, it shouldn't take that long, though. Like, maybe, that's ridiculous.
Maybe 7-8 months, something like that. But you still, like, would you want, like, if you just wanted to read manga, would you want that process every time? Like,
no, the thing, too, is, like, I guess it's there's their mindset, oh, we're printing it, and print is expensive, and especially because I work in print. I know how much it costs to print things. But it's like, guys, in this time, in this era, like, you can get that translated for cheap enough, and then you can put it out digitally. And even if you can make that work, and you don't have to, it doesn't all have to be print. You can do that and get it out there on an iPad or whatever device, a Kindle or a Nook or whatever the heck you look at to read your digital stuff. And it's just as good. Especially with a lot of this stuff, I don't see why it has to be printed. Again, that's somebody who works in print for a living, who's sort of shunning his own job. But like, I don't think it needs to, like, I don't think all of this needs to be printed. Like, it can be translated, and you can read it digitally, and it's just as good. Same thing.
Hope, do you have any thoughts?
No, I think you just about covered it. Like, that's the most I know about any of that.
Okay. All right. Let's. Worden asks, considering how shitty 2014 was, what was the best thing about it for you? Well, Hope and I got engaged, so that was great.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a kitty and a bunny.
I mean, like, it was bad for the internet in the last quarter of the year. It was a bad time to be online and to be attached to nerd culture. But apart from that, 2014 wasn't shitty for me personally, so it was pretty good. I 2014 was good for me, so.
Well, there you go. I guess that's good for me, too, because we spent it together. Brady?
I mean, the best thing about 2014, still alive? I don't know. It's been a really rough year. I don't know. I work too much. So it's been a rough year. My family's had a lot of bad health. So, I mean, I guess the best thing is just that... people are still hanging in there, and I'm hanging in here, and things are still going. I guess I got to renovate my office So it's not like a, it doesn't look like the 1970s hippie basement anymore.
That's good.
I'm sort of happy about that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I know I need more of a social life.
Well, you know, it sounds like you had a few bright spots.
Oh yeah, I mean, yes, it could have been worse. I look forward to hanging out with you guys on Skype. So
that's my
bright spot.
Aw, thanks, Brandy. Okay, Noblesse asks, is Funimation directly challenging Crunchyroll's dominance in the streaming game? Okay, so this is, I'm happy to...
You have mail.
No, excuse me.
Banner ads.
I'm happy to take this question.
You have a 1993 computer with AOL on it, apparently.
Yeah, no, there's a banner ad when you mouse over it. It makes it nice. All right, so I'm happy to take this question, because... this season you're seeing something come to fruition, which is obviously Funimation is spending a lot of money locking up the North American rights, exclusive North American streaming rights to pretty much everything that anyone's paying any attention to outside of a few titles. Those two companies are in direct competition with each other. I know this is hard to consider. It's hard to believe that the anime industry has two big companies with lots of money that are actually fighting for your business right now, but they are, believe it or not. Those two companies are in competition. And right now, the land grab is exclusive streaming rights for North America, I have been made to understand, is the sweetest plum secondary to global exclusive streaming rights. So if you get every territory and you're the only person streaming it, that's where all of the money is. And so you have these two companies that are fighting for those streaming licenses. Funimation seems chiefly concerned with locking down North American exclusive because that's where their biggest market is, yada, yada, yada. But what they're doing is competing. This is competition. You're going to see it heat up, I would say, a lot over the next couple of years. This is only going to get more interesting as we go on, so it's fun as an industry watcher to just kind of sit back and see where it goes. Anything beyond that, I can't really say. I can say that we will have Funimation on next week for our interview show, so if you have questions for Funimation about all this stuff, send them to me next week when I put the call up for that. So look forward to that. Okay. Lord Geo asks, with Animagos Bubblegum Crisis Blu-ray sets finally released, do you feel that Animagos whole under... The whole funder decided what?
Whole? Because like every, I think what they mean is that every single decision about that set was an email.
Oh yeah,
that was required every single person to. It's like, so should I turn this to the left or should I turn to the right? Answer in our poll. Like that. That's what they, I think they mean.
Yeah. I got those. Did you get those, Brady?
I got a million. Yes. It was just like, there was too many emails.
No, I meant the Blu-rays, but obviously if you got one, you got the other. What do you think of that set?
I have it right here, and, all right, so I design for a living, and I don't like to, crap on design, but I feel like the decision for them to use sketch artwork as the background for everything was a really, really bad decision. I think it looks very bad. I think the printing is sort of cheap.
Yeah, that was my thought. It looks like it came from somebody's inkjet.
Yeah. Which, honestly, though, I was surprised that the that Cowboy Bebop LE from Amazon that everybody keeps, fighting for, the printing, especially on the art book in that is almost as cheap as this, which surprised me because that's such an expensive set they were selling. I was surprised just how cheap the printing was. And I mean, at the end of the day, it's the show that talks, but as a shelf piece, it's definitely the design could have been better and they could have done a little bit of a better job.
Yeah, although I guess complaining now, it's not like I wasn't ever asked for my feedback on any of that. So, right.
Well, here's the thing: you were asked for the feedback, but it's like I can take a picture of this box and it's going to look fine. There's no way you could feasibly have printing feedback, right? Like, short of them sending you here's five samples, which do you think looks better? You're not really going to know from a picture what the printing is like. It's just impossible.
No, you're right. Yeah. Now it's fine. The show looks fine. I'll probably watch it at some point. I haven't seen it since the 90s, so maybe time to revisit. But yeah, that was my thought. Was like, this looks like something someone made, like with their hands, not something that came off of a professional press or anything. It doesn't look that bad, I guess. But it's I don't know. I was kind of underwhelmed.
Having to work in cheap printing a lot. There's a lot of tricks you can do, and I think, and this is sort of I guess a technical thing, but it really depends what tone of black they picked to use on the background and what their designer was doing, because when you convert an RGB picture to COIMK, you with something that's completely black like this, you have to choose the designer or the person who finalizes the files has to know enough to pick the right mixture of cyan, yellow, magenta, and black. And what it looks like to me happened on the covers of this is that they just converted their RGB files to COIMK and they didn't think about the black, what black they were choosing for that. And I think that's also why it looks like the black looks more gray, which is sort of the default of what Photoshop does. So I think that might happen too, and that sort of leads to it a little bit. But I don't know. That's just my take.
Madman 40096 asks, do you feel the increased emphasis on streaming will ultimately hurt anime dubbing? I don't know. Hope, what do you think?
Well, obviously Funimation has already, jumped on that with doing that simuldub stuff, which I, mea culpa, have not seen any of those, so I have no idea if they sound rushed or whatever. I know that the properties that they picked for that were, a show that seems like not many people care about, and then one that was, super hyped, but quality may vary. So I hated the one. I wasn't interested in the one that quote unquote nobody cares about. And then I reviewed in Japanese and absolutely hated the one that that people did care about. So I didn't want to go back and watch it in English because I didn't like the show. But it's clearly they're jumping on that as a dubs aren't going to go away thing. And I think that's because a lot of Funimation's buyer's market are fans of the Funimation brand of personality, the cult of personality, their stable of voice actors, their particular marketing faces and stuff like that. They like that, and I think Funimation wants to continue to make a profit off of the fandom for their dubs, and that's completely understandable. They have this in-house dubbing studio. They want to be able to use it. So I think that the increased simulcasting stuff definitely will decrease the number of dubs. The number of dubs have been decreasing for a good long time anyway. And, but I think that certain companies are probably eager to, circumvent that with stuff. And there's always going to be some of it because, that's the easiest way to get anybody to pay attention to a show who might not normally be a super hardcore anime fan is put it in English. There are people just will not watch cartoons with subtitles on them. They won't do it. So you got to put it in English. It's not going to go away completely, no. I think it'll just decrease at a similar rate to what it has been.
I think someone in the chat just brought up that English dubs are valuable if you want your show to be on Netflix or Hulu, which is where the money is right now. Those two companies pay very good money for content libraries, and they buy a lot of anime, or they license a lot of anime. And so the investment in a dub is frequently to get the money from selling your show to Netflix or Hulu, getting it, licensing it to them. I would suspect that, if anything, the number of dubs, over the next couple of years, I don't think it'll decrease dramatically. I don't think streaming is going to have an immediate impact on it or anything like that. If anything, we might see more, and they might be made cheaper. I can definitely see the prices being driven down.
Yeah, I think that if there's the biggest change that'll be made, it's probably just that they'll be made cheaper. Funimation is non-union stuff, and that probably helps a lot. But they can record in-house, and it's non-union, so they're saving money.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine it's just sort of it's kind of baselined as it is, right? The shows that they dub are ones that sort of at this point are, we know we're going to either going to get this on TV or it's going to sell fairly well on DVD, Blu-ray, and there you go. Like, that's like the only way it seems that these shows are getting dubbed. And even with some of Funimation's titles, like, there's some titles which they're just rushing through and getting it dubbed as quickly as possible, just so it has a dub. That you know, fan service shows and whatnot, just sort of a lot of, like, similar to, not as bad, but similar to how Sentai sort of just pushes through dubs on certain things just to get it dubbed and done, to either fulfill their contracts or to, you know, to have that checkbox on the back of the box that says, oh, this has got English on it and people want to watch it in English. We're in a weird place where they've sort of figured out streaming, like they've sort of made it work, and the thousands and thousands of dollars it takes to dub things doesn't make sense to the streaming.
And it's crazy because I feel like about 3 years ago or so, people would talk about how, oh yeah, we're pushing streaming, but you know, it's not profitable. You can't, you have to have pull so many views to turn any kind of ad profit on streaming. Like 3 or 4 years ago that people were saying that, and now it's where the money is. It's amazing how fast things change.
Well, I mean, it's not just anime, but it's turned around the entire television industry, really.
Oh yeah. Like,
indeed. We'll see how it goes. I think the next couple of years are going to be pretty interesting. In general, for the U.S. industry, like, as a whole. Let's see. East Thunder asks, what do you think about how sports anime, which was the least popular genre in sales and views for a long time, is gaining more and more popularity over the past few years? Do you think it's deserved, or is it just a random trend that'll fade away soon? Sports anime seems to be on the upswing because it happens to be a genre that fits in quite well with Fujoshi staples, I guess.
Yeah.
And so the big hit sports shows are all also Fujoshi hits.
Yeah.
So shows that are going to have a lot of dudes in them.
Haikyuu is not popular because people like volleyball all of a sudden. It's popular because the characters are these, like, cute, lovable boys that girls apparently want to smush together and make them kiss. Like, that's what that is. I mean, there's boy fans of it, too. It's a production IG show. It's supposed to hit a larger market. So there's younger guy fans who are like, hey, he's like me. He's an underdog, you know, etc. But the Fujoshi market for that show is huge. So that's a lot of it.
Yeah, most of the hit shows, Haikyuu, Kuroko's Basketball, obviously, Yoipita, like, those are all in the Fujoshi section of the Animate. Like, mm-hmm. All those sports shows are over there.
Yeah.
So that's the market. That's why they're popular right now. I would imagine that's not going to fade. Like, women as an audience for this stuff in Japan isn't going to, like, it's not a fad.
Yeah, it's like it's been burgeoning for a while, and suddenly the tidal wave broke, like, a year or two ago, yeah. And now it's, you know, which is great, because it's funny to watch the fallout from that. It's funny to watch the grossly divided opinions on that, but yeah.
But, yeah, no, the companies decided, hey, these people have money, too, so let's give them their fantasy material.
When we went to Japan, it was free everywhere. Oh, yeah, like, all the booby shows were on the third floor of the building, and the first floor was free in Utapri, which Utapri hasn't hit here, and it makes me sad, because it should have, because it's very entertaining.
Yeah, it doesn't seem very popular at all.
it's not. I think it's because it wasn't like Sentai just kind of picked it up and dumped it, but and also it's based in idol culture, which is not as maybe universal as swimming or whatever, but it's just as entertaining as free is. Not as well animated, but just as fun.
Let's go. Cryptic asks, have you ever invested significant time and money in an anime, bought DVDs or watched it constantly, that you later wish you hadn't? So I guess long show that you bought a bunch of and then we're like, why did I do this?
One Piece.
Really? One Piece?
I don't dislike it. It's just that I realized, like, it's never going to end, and I probably shouldn't have started trying to get invested. Like, I'm never going to be able to catch up with it. I liked what I saw of it, but the fact of the matter is, I'm never going to be able to catch up. Like, there's just not enough time in a day. So I bought quite a bit of One Piece and eventually recently sold it all because it was like, I can't, there's too much of it, I can't do it, so yeah.
One Piece is one of those shows where, like, if there's a new one of those now, like, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is kind of it now, like, super long-running shonen thing, although that is much less of a guaranteed will-run-forever, but getting in on the ground floor is kind of crucial.
Right.
Because in order to have seen 600 episodes of One Piece, you have to have been kind of watching it for 600 weeks.
Right.
You know, like, otherwise you'll never catch up, you'll never see it all.
And ever. I really like Togashi. I really, really like that guy. Everybody says that Hunter x Hunter is, like, better than Yu Yu Hakusho. I love Yu Yu Hakusho. I think it's fucking great. I never like, finished Hunter x Hunter because it just kind of went on and on and on, too. And people say it's better or whatever. But it's just, like, I like things that are short. I like it when things end. When people are like, don't you wish this got another season? If it had a... I say yes if it didn't have a compelling conclusion, but if it had a nice, solid conclusion, I'm always like, no, I'm glad that it's not, that it doesn't go on into eternity and have time to get cheap or lame or ruin itself. Like, I'm glad that it's a complete story. So for that stuff, it's frustrating. If I like something and it turns out it's gonna last forever, that's frustrating.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm forever done with the, you know, hundreds and hundreds of episodes long Shonen Jump thing, but... JoJo's, if it goes into the hundreds of episodes, which it probably will, that'll probably be the one that I watch.
Yeah, well, the thing with JoJo's is there are, like, nice clean-cut stopping points, like...
Yeah.
Part one, a complete story. Part two, a complete story. Part three, a complete story. So, you know, you're good.
Well, you can go in on that show and say, oh, I'm going to watch this segment of it if you really want
to. Yeah, I'm just going to start with part seven. You could do that. I think that's why it's run for so long, because you can start with part seven or whatever. It's a standalone story.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I imagine a lot of the reason why it still goes now is because he just starts and stops the story, but, like, he completely reinvents the thing each time. Like, right. Like, oh, this time it's going to be about a race, like a horse race across the West or whatever. Like, it's just, he sort of just... does what he wants to do, like what he likes to do, and he doesn't really. It doesn't seem like he really cares if people are going to read it or not.
Yeah,
it's just going
to
be whatever he wants
JoJo
to do.
JoJo in it.
Lord Terminal asks, do you think there are any video games that would make for a decent anime adaptation? I mean, sure. You know, it all depends on whether or not they make the anime for a wider audience, or they just make it for people who've played the game and they're just ticking off boxes on a checklist.
I would watch Fire Emblem.
Yeah, I can't imagine that.
Of course,
too far
you will.
Off. I cannot imagine that's too
There's
far
so
away.
Many games, but, like, I mean, I say I would watch Fire Emblem because I think it's just something about that aesthetic appeals to me, because I liked Utaura Ramono, and that show was totally average, but I really enjoyed it because of the aesthetic, and that it is the same kind of aesthetic as Fire Emblem, which is, like, half animal, half people. It's not furries, it's not weird fetishy, but just half animal, half people in super earthy fantasy settings that has, like, basic weaponry and very basic magic. Like, it's not anything complicated. It's just this earthy, simple kind of... You know, I like that stuff.
I don't know. I'd like to see Nintendo take another stab at their, like... what they sort of do is they license out their, like, B titles to be anime. Like, they'll do, like, F-Zero or...
Right.
Or Kirby or whatever. And I'd like to see them take another stab at, like, a Mario or actually do, like, a Zelda or something like that. I think that would be cool. And the thing with Nintendo is it feels like they're very reserved, and I think they're very smart and, like, sort of in protecting their characters. But it seems like they're taking more chances with things they're doing lately. So I'd like to see them do that. Like, just take some of their A-game characters and do some sort of other kind of multimedia with them.
You just want a Gyromite anime.
Oh, exactly. And there has to be, like, a cell phone game or something or a peripheral for my Wii U. That to continue on the episodes, I have to have a little robot smash my screen on my Wii U controller
right.
Just to get to the extra, like, get past the commercial breaks.
Yeah. Totally fucking pointless peripheral.
I had that as a kid. I just put the other controller on the floor and pressed my toes.
Yeah.
And
right.
I totally cheated my way through Gyromite.
Yeah. Well, otherwise you got to sit there and wait for the stupid robot, and the robot doesn't always get it right. Like, anyway. Oh, okay. Surrender Artist asks, we'll finish up with this one. Why do you value or enjoy abstraction in anime, such as in the work of Kunihiko Ikuhara? Okay, so this is like saying, why do you like abstract imagery?
Right.
Which is very hard for me to parse, because it's... personally, I feel a pretty deep connection to that kind of thing. It speaks to me on a really... primal level. My favorite type of art, my favorite school of art is abstract surrealism. I really like emotions and ideas and concepts that are expressed visually in a way that makes you think about them differently and conceptualizes them differently. Mm-hmm. I think it can be a really, really powerful and even subliminally effective way of communicating emotions and relationships and things about life in ways that straightforward words can't. And I think there's a fundamental principle about the value of art in here somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it just, I don't know. I think it's a beautiful way to express yourself and often allows for more nuance and subtlety in a work that it's like a component of storytelling that just adds to your thing. Like, it's like music or dialogue or color palette or cinematography or any of that stuff. If you use a little bit of abstract symbolism or imagery, you can express ideas that maybe your dialogue doesn't have time for.
Yeah.
It's a really powerful tool in filmmaking, and it's one of the most effective for me personally. So, I guess.
Oh yeah. I mean, like I feel the same way, especially about, basically I like abstract imagery because I do think it has the capability to, it's one thing to say something in a work of fiction, to say, oh, I feel this way, the world is like this, or I am like this, or you know, I believe this because, and explain it, or have a practical thing happen to explain it. And it's another thing to prove it, and I think abstract imagery can do a lot in, like, proving a point, or proving, like, why a character is changing a certain way, or how they see the world, by presenting this truth in a way that is, like, not, you haven't seen it before. And it forces, when you have an abstract symbol like that, it forces you to try and to attach something to it. Like, it begs to be understood in some way. So it makes you, it forces you to confront what the image is and what it means. And it can make you, it doesn't even have to be something crazy like Ikuhara. It can be really basic, and it can improve things that might otherwise just be simple. Like, the thing that I wanted to mention for abstract imagery is, like, Auron High School Host Club, which is a super, like, super standard, rote kind of reverse harem thing on the surface, but it's a lot of it is greatly improved by peppering everything with Utena-like abstract imagery. And what most fans, a lot of fans' favorite episode is the Kyoya episode, where he's a character who is trying to, who is supposed to babysit this, he was supposed to babysit this naive French visitor to Japan. It's Tamaki. He's supposed to look after him and give him everything he wants. And he's frustrated by this, but he's, like, doing his best to please him in order to, like, gain status with his family, because he's really trying to leech off his riches. And they illustrate this by, like, he comes home after each day of, like, you know, manipulating people and getting what he wants from them, and he, like, folds his clothes and he puts them away nice and neat, and his sister puts the stuff away for him, and he closes it up, and his house looks nice and neat. And every time he comes home from his interactions with this French person, his clothes are, like, everywhere. They're slung on top of a thing, and it zooms out, and it's like his room gets progressively more covered in clothing that he's been wearing all day at, like, Kyoto or wherever he's been drug off to. And it does a great job, because he on the outside can't express this because he's this really emotionally cloistered person who buries all this. So you have this image that really speaks to what's happening in his head, where, you know, he's slowly losing it. And it's stuff like that where it's like, hey, this instantly makes the show better. It does, like, because otherwise it would be something maybe that you've seen many times before, but this gives it a new level of depth and understanding. So, yeah, stuff like that.
All right.
No, I mean, I think the basic tenet of storytelling is, you know, show, don't tell, right? Like, of good storytelling. And I think the power to evoke a mood, this person's sad, with just a color is a very powerful thing, right? So, I think that combined with the fact that, like, a lot of shows are very samey or are just, let's copy the Kyoani way of doing it, or let's copy this or that because this worked, right? And to see shows which visually do something different with their backgrounds or just scenes in general, that is just refreshing to see that today. Just with how much stuff is carbon copy of this other thing that worked and just pushed out there. I mean, it's like that's in all media, but in anime in particular, it happens. So I think that's why it's refreshing personally for me.
All right, cool. Yeah, yeah. Good question. I'm happy to answer that, but I feel like there's no way for me to like. I wish I would have to sit down and write that out. Like yeah. That would be something I need to more carefully consider my explanation for, because it is a fundamental part of who I am, I think. Anyway, that does it for us. Thanks to everyone in the chat for showing up. Brady, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you for having me, as always. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and we'll see you all next week. Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Brady for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a rating, a little review. We'd appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.